Tales of the Left Hand, Book 3, written and read by John Maher. Chapter 1.
I cannot believe we are doing this, Grievous snapped.
Will you just hold still, Carola snapped right back. You've been avoiding this for 3 days. And stop flinching. This can't possibly hurt. I do this for myself all the time.
I look ridiculous.
Carola sighed. It would be easier if you just wear the wig.
I will not, the Sabrian retorted. It is not even a proper wig. It looks as if you cut the end off of a mop.
I did no such thing. There was a pause. Clegg did it for me.
Grievous swore. Enough of this. I am going on deck. We should be in sight of Maipur by now.
You're not going anywhere looking like that.
You put it on me. Now take it off.
It's not finished. If I take it off, I'll have to start all over again.
Either you remove it now, or I will go on deck looking like this, and you can explain the reason why.
Damn it, Caius! Grievous stopped before the cabin door, turning back to glare at her. Don't give me that look, Carola went on. I think we know each other well enough to use first names. Why are you putting up such a fight over this? You know it's a good idea.
Grievous drew in a deep breath, then let it out slowly. I am not comfortable wearing this false skin.
He raised his arms.
My hands, white as a slug's belly, or a northerner's corpse.
How evocative, Carola quipped. I didn't realize you were also a poet back in the Empire. As for the skin color, I haven't added a tan yet. The illusion will look more natural once I get that done.
And my face, the Sabrian went on, reaching past her to pick up a small mirror sitting on the bunk next to her. He stared at his reflection. It is the face of a stranger.
That's the whole point. Grievous paused, studying the face in the mirror. He turned his head left and right.
Have you given me Dutrom's nose?
Carola looked away, slightly embarrassed. Well, it certainly won't be mistaken for yours.
Grievous made a disgusted sound. The worst is the hair. My eyes tell me it is there, but when I try to touch it...
He brought his hand up and tried to brush the hair.
My fingers tell me it is not. He shuddered. I cannot abide this.
Like I said, Carola explained, it would be easier if you wear the wig we made. That way, your fingers will feel something if you touch it. Also, if there's something actually there to wrap the illusion around, I think it will be much easier for me to make the fake hair look real. The mana's a lot stronger here, but I'm still having to maintain 2 full disguises on my own. She ran a hand through her own hair, now colored a deep red. Anything to make this a little easier would be appreciated.
It feels unnatural.
I cast this spell on the Duke himself, she retorted, losing patience. It's just an illusion. It won't do you any harm.
You believed that about your repair spell as well.
Carola flinched as if he'd struck her. Grievous himself seemed taken aback at the comment. For a long moment, the two of them stared at each other. At length, Grievous cleared his throat.
My apologies. What happened during the battle with Sidois was not your fault.
Carola looked away. Yes, it was. I should have known better than to try something like that. No new magic from here on in. I'm only using the spells I already know in the ways that I know will work. Grievous opened his mouth to reply, but a moment later there came a knock at the door. That you, Wick? Carola called.
Aye, mistress. I've news from the captain.
Grievous turned to the door to unlock it, then stepped back to give the guard room to enter.
We're in sight of Maipur and...
Wick began, but he broke off as he looked at the two people standing before him.
Do not dare laugh, Grievous warned him.
Carola smiled at Wick's stunned expression, but she kept herself under control. Wick, close the door. Wick obeyed, his stare sliding from Grievous to herself.
Castellan Kelvo told me you could make yourself look fully human, mistress. I've seen you as a ginger before, but your ears, your eyes.
He smiled, shaking his head.
I'd not peg you as an elf in 100 years now.
He looked back at Grievous, frowning.
Pardon my saying so, but the captain's hair doesn't look right. Sort of like someone's put a costume helmet on his head.
You see, Grievous said, this disguise is pointless.
Behind him, Wick raised a hand and batted at Grievous's hair, fascinated at the way his hand passed through it without resistance. Wick, stop that, Carola said in exasperation. Fine, fine, no hair.
She closed her eyes and made an adjustment to her spell, removing that element and making sure that the color change to Grievous's skin now covered his scalp. "You can wear a hat or something." Grievous examined his new appearance with a critical frown, seeming to accept the alteration as a form of compromise.
"If I must," he sighed.
"You must," she told him. "Look, the Fanes have agents in every port in the Freeze. Like as not, the very day you became the Duke's guest, Drax and Fane put the word out to report on any Sabrians they see, especially an older male like yourself, traveling without even a single servant. By now, they've surely realized that we've left Kohane, but that doesn't mean they know where we're going. If you're spotted in my poor..."
"Very well," Grievous interrupted. "While we are in the city, I will submit to..."
He gestured vaguely at himself.
"This, but no more than that."
He looked back at Kerla.
"Have you completed your adjustments?"
"Yes." She could see that trying to keep him in here was going to be more trouble than it was worth. She understood some part of his agitation. Wick's news that their destination was in sight had filled her with a restless energy as well. "I'll want one more session with you before we leave the ship to make sure I have the spell prepared exactly right. Wick, I'll want you here as well. An extra pair of eyes always helps with this sort of thing." She snapped her fingers as she released the spells disguising Grievous and herself. It was an unnecessary gesture, just showing off, but the expression of disquiet on Grievous's face as the illusions swirled away gave her a small thrill of satisfaction. Grievous examined himself in the mirror carefully to ensure the spell was gone, then gave a relaxed sigh, nodded to Kerla, and left the room.
"Everything all right?" Wick asked.
"I think so," she said wearily. "He just wants to get moving. I understand."
Wick nodded. "Can't say as I blame him, mistress, especially now that the city's in sight. What's the plan once we leave the ship?"
"Get out of the city as quickly and quietly as possible, before the Fanes learn we're here, and head inland to the Abbey of St. Ravino," Kerla said.
"Where the captain resumes his search for the secret island of Predatoris Rex," Wick finished. "You really think the monks can find it for him?"
"Well, I don't think they're helping him find it so much as making their map archives available. Hopefully one of their maps will show the same features as the half of old Rex's map that Grievous has."
"And from there?"
"From there?" She sighed. The temptation to tell Wick the full story was strong. There was more to their mission than escorting Grievous to the Abbey so he could track down the secret haven of a legendary pirate. Her dear friend Tesca Sicarius, Duke Stephen's left hand, had been given a second mission by his grace when they had left Kohane. He had shared the basics of that mission with her in case something happened to him. There was a boy living at the Abbey named Jordan, who was secretly Duke Stephen's son and heir, and the Duke had decided the time had come to bring the lad home. The mission to escort Grievous was a smokescreen, a diversion for the Duke's enemies to focus on. Now that Tesca was gone and Kerla had claimed his rank, the responsibility for that mission fell to her. "I should tell Wick," she thought. "What if something happens to me the way it did to Tesca? The boy still needs to be brought home, and he'll be the only one of the Duke's people left who can do it." But she held back. "Wick's a soldier, not a spy. Grievous will read him like an open book, and if the captain thinks he's been tricked, I don't know what he'll do." "Hold off for now," she decided. "When we're off the ship and out of the city, when things are a little less chaotic, then find a time to pull Wick aside and tell him." "From there," she repeated, "I don't think there's any point in looking further ahead than that. Let's find out where the island is first."
"Aye, mistress. Want to go up on deck?"
She grinned. "Oh, yes. I'm as eager to see land as anyone aboard. Let me put on a quick disguise first, though," she added, closing her eyes and making a few precise gestures, tugging the mana into place around her with familiar ease. This was her most basic illusion, changing the color of her skin and hair without changing her elven features. She chose the disguise she called Mouse, tan skin and dark brown hair, because it was the way the Cutlass's crew had seen her most of the time. By now, they all knew what she really looked like, of course, but she'd found it was best to keep providing them with what they were most accustomed to. There were enough angry or scared sailors on this ship as it was.
"Was that ginger disguise you had on before the one you'll be using off the ship?" Wick asked.
"You mean Jenny Red?" Wick nodded. "I'd like to. I haven't had a chance to bring her out for some time. I like the freckles best. They were the hardest part to get right."
"Doing all this magic at once isn't tiring you out?"
When I'm holding two full disguises for myself and Grievous, it's a little draining, but this, she gestured at herself, this doesn't cost me anything at all.
Is the, Wick paused to recall the word, the mana stronger here, or is it that you've been using the disguises so often they're easier to do?
A bit of both, she mused. The mana is a lot stronger here than I expected. It feels like the last time I was on the mainland, and that was at least 5 or 6 years ago. But I've also been using my disguises a great deal in places where the mana is weaker, so I've gotten better at using what little was there. She motioned Wick towards the door. She'd avoided coming up on deck as much as she could since the battle, feeling it was best for everyone if she remained out of sight. The furtive glances in her direction from the crew as they became aware of her presence were not the hateful glares that Tovas had given her. Instead, they looked at her with thinly veiled fear and moved out of her way, even changing the direction they were walking to avoid crossing her path. She couldn't blame them. The evidence of her failure was everywhere to see. The magical deformities wreaked upon the Cutlass 3 days earlier by Kerla's rogue spell had been repaired as best they could while at sea. Gaps in the hull where the timbers had shifted position and shape had been plugged with whatever was at hand. These stopgap measures were holding for the time being, but Kerla knew Captain Dutrom was looking forward to fresh supplies and a chance to make more comprehensive repairs. Some of those will take a while, she thought, looking up at the masts, which now resembled barren trees growing out of the deck. Sails hung from the warped yardarms in a confused patchwork, the crew stretching canvas wherever they could find a place to make the best speed they could. The sun was behind the Cutlass as it limped past the breakwater. Bathed in the early morning light, the city of Maipur was spread along the shore of a sheltered bay on the southeastern coast of the island that shared its name. The ground rose in a steady slope away from the water, though not nearly so steeply as it did in Kohain.
"Good morning, mademoiselle," Captain Dutrom said to her as she and Wick came up into the forecastle. She smiled at him in greeting.
Next to Dutrom, Lieutenant Bristow gave her a long look before making a quick nod, more of an acknowledgement than a greeting. Grievous was at the rail, watching the city through his telescope. Kerla stepped next to Grievous and looked out at the city. She had been here several times, and her eyes quickly picked out some of the landmarks. The Palazzo Trideri, seat of power for the Count of Maipur, rose higher than the buildings surrounding it. Made of, or, she suspected, finished in white stone, it gleamed in the sunlight. Not far from it was the Cathedral of the Daughter's Mercy, smaller, more delicate than the Palazzo, if a massive building made of stone could truly be called delicate. She liked the look of the cathedral better than the Count's palace. For one thing, there was more open space around it, allowing one to see the architecture more clearly.
"She's bigger than Kohain," Wick remarked.
"Not really," she replied. "It's more spread out than Kohain, but the buildings are generally only one or two floors here. Back home, folk build up rather than out."
"Is there a holiday in progress?" Grievous asked, still looking through his telescope.
He gestured to the large orange banners flying from several points around the harbor and the tallest buildings near the water.
"I have observed that Kohain is festively decorated for the Duke's ascension festivities. Perhaps this is the same."
"No, monsieur," Dutrom replied. "Those banners are a warning to us."
Grievous turned back to look at the captain.
"Us?" "To all ships approaching the harbor."
"We've much the same in Kohain," Wick replied. "Red flags atop the towers of the Eyes and Teeth warns of plague, but I don't know what orange signifies."
"That is because it is a hazard that the Quad does not experience," the captain replied with a sigh. "Armorbacks. A common enough problem in the shallower waters of the Northern Frieze. When a colony of the creatures takes up residence close to a coastal city, the orange banners are flown."
"How dangerous are they?" Wick asked.
"That depends on the size of the colony and how hungry they are."
Dutrom raised his own spyglass to his eye.
"I see at least some open berths at the docks. That is fortunate. If every berth was full, I would not wish to remain in the harbor after sunset. We do not carry equipment to repel armorbacks."
"We don't?" Kerla asked. Dutrom set his mouth in a grim line, his gaze still on the city before them.
"As a matter of routine, mademoiselle, ships of His Grace's navy never do. There is no need for it patrolling the Quad's abyssal waters. And as you may recall, before we were given new orders to meet your party, We were in the middle of a training cruise.
Kerla shrugged, conceding the point.
Well, it's not long after the damp, she ventured. Armorbacks usually don't become aggressive until the summer months, right?
In my experience, mademoiselle, the time of year has less to do with armorbacks' behavior than their hunger.
A gleam of light from the city caught her eye.
Spyglass, she said, pointing towards the city, as much to change the subject as anything else. Someone's taking a look at us.
Dutram smiled.
The first of many. We are fortunate in one thing. To arrive at this hour means we will see why Maipur is sometimes called the City of Shining Eyes.
Shining Eyes? Wick asked, looking concerned.
Kerla laughed. Any ship coming into any port attracts attention. It's just that in Maipur, with the way the city is spread out and the sun behind us, we'll see the glint of light reflecting off any spyglasses turned our way.
I see, Wick replied. Oh, there's another. And another.
Kerla could see more glints appearing here and there in the city, and it wasn't long before each of those glints doubled, then tripled.
Were the spreading of our approach, Dutram sighed. With the light behind us, our silhouette reveals our unique, condition. We must look quite astonishing.
Kerla could imagine what was happening all over the city, numerous variations on a simple scene. A stunned sailor holding a spyglass calling to a passerby.
Oi, mate, do me a favor and take a look at that ship coming in, and tell me what you see. I just need to know I'm not going mad.
The entire city will be talking about us before noon, Kerla muttered, thinking hard about what that was going to mean. Even if the Fane's agents here don't spot Grievous, they can't fail to mention our arrival. Word will get back to the Quad, and it won't take long for Drax and Fane to put the pieces together. She estimated the time for a round-trip journey between Maipur and the Quad. Week and a half at the very least, more likely two. It's a lead, but not as long a one as I'd like.
Dutram turned to Lieutenant Bristow.
Trim the sails to one quarter. Bring us in slow.
Begging your pardon, sir,
Wick asked as the lieutenant stepped away to pass the order to the crew.
But haven't we been warned about armorbacks out here with us?
Armorbacks sleep during the day, Corporal, the captain explained patiently. Standard procedure here is for the harbor authorities to send a launch out to inspect the ship and ensure that we are not bringing plague or similar contagion with us. Given our current state, I expect their caution will be tenfold.
He gestured towards one end of the harbor.
You will note the harbor battery is manned. They will not hesitate to sink us if we ignore the protocols and race for shore.
Grievous turned his telescope in that direction.
Several cannon and other devices.
Ballista? Wick asked.
No, Kerla said, looking that way herself. Three trebuchets. They're phasing out the cannons here as well, I see.
Prudence requires it, Dutram replied. When we return home, I will inform His Grace that the same thing should be considered in Kohin. Cannon are nearly obsolete here. It is only a matter of time before the same occurs in the Quad.
Grievous frowned at that as he turned his attention to the center of the city.
There is a launch leaving dock, he reported. I see two flags. One is blue and white. Those are Maipur's colors, yes? The second flag shows the colors of Duke Stephen, but with a blue band along the outer edge. A good sign, Dutram replied with satisfaction. They have seen that we fly the Duke's flag and have gotten the Kohian commissioner out of bed to greet us.
Commissioner? Grievous asked. I am unfamiliar with the term.
Galen explained it to me, Kerala said. None of the Frees have formal embassies with their neighbors. Mostly it's too expensive to keep official representatives on even the major islands all the time, to say nothing of the 24 or more smaller ones. So at some point, the rulers started appointing merchants who were already living on those islands as commissioners. Essentially, they're on retainer to maintain a working relationship with the local ruler, to make it easier to deliver messages between the two sovereigns.
Grievous looked scandalized.
The Duke allows merchants to negotiate on his behalf.
No, nothing like that, Kerla said. The commissioners don't have any formal powers as an ambassador might, but if Count Valian wanted to get a message to the Duke, the commissioner is there to make sure the message arrives and vice versa.
Merchants never do something for nothing, Grievous commented. How do they profit from this?
They get a commission, hence the name, but that's really a token fee. The real benefit for them is what Galen calls the perks.
Commissioners generally get something like a reduced tariff fee on goods they bring into port, or prices for them are slightly lower than they are for others.
These perks, as you call them, vary between islands, Dutram added, though usually the greater the responsibilities, the more substantial these perks are. These people are running their own businesses, you see. Time spent in diplomatic matters takes them away from that business. He chuckled. And in my poor, the commissioners are kept rather busy, almost as much as if they were true ambassadors. Depending on how Valion is feeling about their respective islands, they are required to actually attend Valion's court.
I didn't know my poor took the custom to that level, Kerla said. Wick gestured at the launch that was heading towards them.
If this fellow's got to attend court, I imagine the perks must be rather nice.
It seems a system prone to corruption, Grievous objected. These men are not performing this task out of loyalty or duty, but for profit. Surely that means they are swayed by others offering greater profit.
I asked Galen about that myself, Kerla replied. He said that the system actually polices itself rather well. Being a commissioner is a bit of a balancing act. The ruler who's employed you can give the job to someone else, or the hosting ruler can decide that you're no longer welcome at his court. Generally, those who abuse the position make it obvious, and there's always other merchants who'd like the job themselves. They're watching for signs of corruption or incompetence, too. Also, most of the rulers, His Grace included, employ natives of their own islands as their commissioners. That means they have family and property back home, so they risk losing more than just their job.
And there is one further incentive to discourage corruption, Dutram added, at least in my poll. The Count is generous with his discounts for the commissioners, but his people keep careful records. He has made it very clear that a commissioner who loses his job may be required to pay back what was originally discounted or risk imprisonment.
Kerla looked up at Dutram. Really?
The captain nodded. He has done it at least twice, to my knowledge. It's a tool of policy he doesn't need to take out of the box very often. Just knowing that he could serves as a rather effective deterrent.
Grievous nodded, looking both amused and impressed at the tactic.
So, who is this fellow sailing towards us?
Brendan Montrose, I believe, Kerla said, trying to recall more of Galen's lesson.
Correct, Dutram said. He's had the job for some 2 or 3 years now. His father was the Kohayan commissioner before that.
Is it common for these posts to pass from parent to child? Grievous asked.
Only if the child has shown similar qualities of business savvy and as firm a grasp on the goings-on in the city as his parent, Dutram replied. Brendan worked closely with his father, and it was clear that he desired to become the next commissioner, but he had to earn it. His Grace has no use for dilettantes with a sense of entitlement acting as his commissioners.
He looked at Kerla.
How much will you be telling him?
Me? Dutram gestured to the silver handpin on her lapel.
Montrose will want to know what brings a ship of His Grace's navy here to Maipo, especially with the left hand aboard.
And you said that Count Valion meets regularly with the foreign commissioners. She chewed on her lower lip, thinking. Like as not, Montrose will be receiving a summons to the palazzo regarding our arrival once he's had a chance to come here and find out what's going on.
That is Valion's usual method, Dutram agreed. He lets the commissioners inspect the ships that come in from their own islands, and he expects them to arrange matters with his harbor authority.
Sounds lazy, if you don't mind my say-so, Wick commented.
Kerla shook her head. It might look that way, but I suspect that Valion has his own people watching the commissioners closely. He gives them a lot of rein, but that means if he catches them at something, they're in a lot of trouble. She looked at Dutram. Greater responsibility means greater punishment if you fail. Is that how it works here?
Dutram smiled at her. There is steel beneath Valion's velvet touch, mademoiselle.
Kerla knew she would have to tread carefully. Galen had told her that relations between Maipor and the Quad were cordial, almost friendly at times, but they were not allies. The island realms of the Freeze, by an unspoken consensus, did not establish formal alliances.
If you form an alliance with someone, my dear, that implies there is someone else to form an alliance against, Galen had told her. All the Freeze who are not part of that alliance assume they are that alliance's target, and they act accordingly. Things quickly get messy.
And when things get messy, she thought, that's more work for Teska. She caught herself. No, that's more work for me. She touched the silver hand and pushed aside the wave of grief that was rising. You've had your time for that. Move on. She looked at Dutrom.
When Montrose comes aboard, he'll do an inspection?
A cursory one, at least. He'll see that we have no cargo to sell in port, so his next question will be to ask why we're here.
Repairs, Carlo replied, gesturing up at the rigging. Not hard to see why.
That is certainly true, and Brendan can't help us there. The Cutlass flies His Grace's flag. As the Kohaian Commissioner, Montrose can purchase the supplies we need at his reduced rates.
He turned away from the city and gestured for Lieutenant Bristow to approach.
Show the Commissioner to my cabin when he comes aboard, Dutrom instructed him. Brendan will have many questions. I will be the one to answer them.
Very good, sir, Bristow replied.
Will you join me, mademoiselle? Dutrom asked as he started down the stairs. We should make sure that we each have the same story to tell him.
Gladly, sir. Carla looked at Grievous before following. It might be best if you stayed below decks while the commissioner is here. I like to think that Galen would make sure that His Grace's commissioners aren't in the pay of the Thanes, but we shouldn't take any chances.
Grievous did not look pleased at the idea, but he gave a grudging nod, seeing the logic. Wick nodded as well, indicating that he would accompany Grievous, as much for providing the Sabrian with some company as keeping an eye on him. Carla hopped down from the forecastle and headed after Dutrom. The debris in the captain's cabin had been cleared away, and those pieces of furniture that were salvageable had been restored as best as possible. Dutrom was left with one chair and his folding desk. The books that had once been stored on his shelves were now set in short piles along the far wall of the cabin, save one sturdy book that was propping up a broken leg on Dutrom's desk. The ornate folding screen Dutrom had used to separate his bunk from the rest of the cabin was now arranged on the starboard side, partially obscuring the whorled knot of wood that bulged out of the hull.
Some of the repairs are going to take longer than others, Carla said, looking up at the ceiling, where the remains of the Lee Rouge's bowsprit lay against it like a massive root, tendrils embedded deep into the planks.
Dutrom had to dip his head when he walked under it.
Indeed, the captain replied, but repairs to this cabin are purely cosmetic and not a priority.
Very true, Carla said. There was an awkward moment when both she and Dutrom offered the other the single chair. A compromise was reached when Carla leaned against the corner of Dutrom's desk, whereupon the captain sank into the chair with thinly concealed relief.
We're in agreement that the most important thing is to make sure the Cutlass is seaworthy for the return to Kohane?
Most assuredly, mademoiselle, Dutrom said, massaging the knee of his bad leg with a sigh. Before I willingly take her into the open sea once more, the masts and yardarms must be replaced, along with many planks in the hull.
How long will that take?
There are numerous variables within that question. Montrose can only purchase materials that are in supply, for example. That concern does not worry me so much, however, as manpower.
Carla nodded. She could sense the mood on a ship as well as anyone. The crew was near breaking point. If Tovas were still alive, she thought, he'd have worked them up to a mutiny by now.
The more men we have doing repairs, the faster it will go.
I could keep the crew on board and have them do the work on their own, Dutrom offered, though by his tone he didn't think much of it.
No, Carla replied, they need a break, a whole day or at least an evening on shore. She sighed. They won't have to pay for a single drink once folk realize which ship they're from, and their stories will grow with each telling.
You wish to keep a low profile, Dutrom told her. Understandable, of course, but quite impossible. You cannot put out a bonfire by throwing cupfuls of water upon it. The best thing to do is retreat to a safe distance and warm your hands.
She smiled, seeing what Dutrom was suggesting. You want me off the ship, too.
Dutrom chuckled. I am not being inhospitable, mademoiselle. I enjoy your company. But whatever mission has been given to Le Mengosh surely cannot be completed while remaining aboard.
And it will be easier to get things back to normal if I'm not around.
D'accord, Dutrom replied. The rumors will fly like terrified pigeons at first, but if you are not here to start new ones, I believe things will quiet down and we can get to work.
Are you going to hire laborers from the city?
If it means getting the repairs done by the time you return, then I must.
All right, she said. How much time do you think it will take to get the Cutlass seaworthy again? Just the repairs you mentioned before, the masts and the planks in the hull.
I think a safe estimation would be 2 weeks, Dutram replied. Assuming I can get the materials we need and I can hire additional laborers, I feel that is a reasonable estimation.
Kerala grimaced, but nodded in agreement. Dutram's estimation sounded about right to her as well. Her plan had been to reach the abbey, find the Duke's son, and head straight back to Maipur. Then once the boy was bundled aboard the Cutlass, set sail for the Quad before any of the Duke's enemies realized what had happened. This unexpected delay worried her, but she knew it would be foolhardy to rush. Making haste now won't do us any good if the Cutlass sinks halfway home, and the Abbey's got to be a safer place to keep the boy than this city. She smiled. And that gives Grievous some time to examine the Abbey's maps. Maybe I can complete both missions at once.
All right, 2 weeks.
She turned her head towards the front of the ship, hearing the sounds of men calling to each other. I think the Commissioner's launch has arrived.
You may as well wait for him here, Dutram said. He will want to meet you, of course. There is no point pretending you are not here. He will learn of it one way or another.
She nodded. Better this way than through rumor. She stood up. Still, no reason he needs to see more than he has to. She made a few simple gestures, modifying her disguise spell, shifting from mouse to Jenny Red, then overlaid a new illusion atop the color change. In a moment, the contours of her face softened, and her eyes and ears lost their elven shape. Dutram stared at her in wonder.
Why have you not done this before?
The mana wasn't strong enough back home for me to use my full disguise, she explained. This far north? She shrugged.
Incroyable, Dutram laughed, shaking his head. This should be a most interesting meeting, no?
This work is copywritten 2013 and has been written and recorded by John Maher. If you'd like to learn more about the Freeze, get yourself a bit of swag, or comment on this episode, please visit talesoftheleftand.com, where you can also find a link to our official Facebook page, and if you'd like, make a donation to help keep this series going. Thanks for listening.